Welcome to The Historical Gadfly, a podcast devoted to history, current events, good books, and the connections between all three. I'm your host, Timothy Noonan, a graduate student at the University of Oxford. Our email address is historicalgadfly@gmail.com. If you have any questions or suggestions or ideas for future episodes, we'll be glad to hear them. And as always, thanks for tuning in. Well, welcome to the first episode of the Historical Gadfly to take place, as far as I know, outside of the UK. We're recording this episode from Berlin in Germany, and I'm very happy to have a guest who's really well-suited for our first ever German-based episode. Our guest today is Shane Boyle, who is a PhD student at the University of California at Berkeley, and he's working on a project that's tentatively titled Historicizing the German 68, Performance, Provocation, and Radical Thought in Die Neue Linke, or the New Left. So, first off, welcome to the show, Shane.
Thank you.
So, Shane, we're going to cover a lot of topics, mostly, I think, talking about the student movements and protests in Germany in 68, but also trying to connect that with the discipline that you're in, performance studies, as opposed to maybe more historians that we've had on the show before, and so on. But we'll get to that and kind of get to what actually happened in Germany during this period before trying to analyze it. But why don't we start off just with a little bit of personal background. Can you tell us a little bit about where you were born and raised?
So I was born in the early 80s in California, particularly Orange County. Mm-hmm. The only thing special that I have to say about Orange County, as many people might know, is it's one of the most conservative and affluent areas of California, which is, has some very different values than some of the people that I study in my project. Mm-hmm.
It's always interesting. I grew up in Los Angeles and I'm here in Palos Verdes, which, in spite of not being that close to Orange County, is also a really strong Republican stronghold there. Mm-hmm. So I know we can speculate maybe about this conversation on how upbringing has affected choice of topic.
Yeah.
And then at early stages in your education, in high school or even grade school or within your own family, was there any interest in history or the German language or 20th century history and so on? How do you, looking back maybe, how do you explain kind of how you began to come to where you are now in terms of your intellectual interests?
Yeah, as far as the focus on Germany, that's actually a pretty recent development. After I finished undergrad is when I developed a strong interest in Germany. But in terms of interest in history and politics, performance, that's something that, came about very, very early on.
Yeah.
In elementary school, I was really obviously, interested in history. My dad, reads a lot, and that was probably one of the most important things I got from my parents is, an interest in reading and learning, especially like thinking about historical connections and its relationship to politics today. And then in high school, I developed a huge interest in politics. Originally, when you grew up in Orange County, it's hard not to develop certain sympathies towards the right, but that quickly changed as through various teachers, instructors, friends, music, kind of broadened my understanding of the world and politics.
When you were in high school, was this kind of Gingrich era or like more first term Bush administration?
So Bush was elected my senior year of high school, and that was a pretty important period for me because the summer before, I had actually gone to Boys State in California, so this kind of like large gathering sponsored by the American Legion. But I was fortunate enough to be put in a group of guys that we all shared kind of more leftist sensibilities. We're 16, 17, so they're not very sensibilities aren't formed that strongly yet. But we actually explored a lot of things, and this is right about the time that it was becoming clear that it was going to be Bush versus Gore, and then I actually became fairly active in, in the fall of that year around the elections, talking to friends, talking to parents, handing out information, working polls, and then, what happened during that election really had a big influence on me and my faith in represent democracy in California.
And tell me a little bit more about the theater life for you or performing arts also in Orange County or kind of in your youth. And was there a tie between dissatisfaction with institutional politics or the Republican right in your creative life at that stage?
In my creative life, I mean, theater actually also is more of a recent development for as well. I was obviously interested in theater and drama growing up, especially in high school. But in college, I became more and more interested in playwriting. Had a lot of friends that participated in the theater. I myself am not an actor. I'm a director and a dramaturg, and that's something that I've pursued more and more as I've gotten older. But so that, I mean, performance didn't necessarily play a big part, but of course, you know, different forms of literature and films were, you know, really important and helped shape my political understanding as it was developing in high school. So
right. So at the time that the nation is discussing such important issues as Terri Schiavo and so on, you are an undergrad at Duke, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
What did you study there and why?
Well, I went into college trying to figure out whether I was going to study chemistry or political science, and then become a lawyer. And then I took my first English and literature classes as a freshman just because I loved reading. And at Duke, the literature department there has a number of really amazing professors, all of whom, you know, identify as Marxists or have, you know, contributed in some regards to Marxist studies, Marxist literary theory.
Yeah.
And that really, you know, I finally found, you know, something that kind of combined my interests in, you know, the arts. And for the first time, I started reading a lot of texts that, you know, really kind of clarified my understandings of the world of how, of contemporary politics and some of my dissatisfactions with things. So I ended up majoring in English with a minor in literature and a minor in theater studies.
Yeah.
One thing I
would wonder about, and I think a lot of listeners would be interested in, is it seems certainly growing up in Orange County, of all places, there's this very triumphalist narrative about American power and, of course, the collapse of the Soviet Union, collapse of communism. What did the concept of, like, the left or, like, an American left or Marxism mean at, like, that stage or to, like, some of the professors and mentors you worked with? I don't mean to phrase this in too crude of a way, like saying, oh, you know, Soviet Union collapse, obviously this is all just stupid. Yeah. But tell us a little bit about that scene and kind of what were some of the basic principles or kind of the thrusts of the criticism that was being done in this tradition.
Well, one of my professors at Duke was Michael Hart, who in 2001 with Antonio Negri published this book, Empire, which I think I was a sophomore when I first even tried reading it. But that was, you know, the big text that was discussed at Duke for basically the 4 years I was there. It was this concept of empire. So that's, you know, not necessarily, you know, it's obviously came 10, 11, 12 years, a decade after the collapse of communism. So it was really obviously the left trying to come to terms with where we are now, especially in a time of increasing mobilizations against globalization. So that was the discourse that was going on. And that really, really influenced me as an undergraduate and then some of the activist projects and things I became involved in after finishing my degree.
And what, I've been to Durham once before, and I guess I'd just be curious to know what were concretely some of the kinds of organizing activities that were going on among students there?
Well, so I think it was my second week of classes that 9/11 happened. And, you know, that was obviously a major, another major event. You know, I just moved from California to Durham, North Carolina, which, you know, if there's Ivory Tower University, it's probably going to be Duke in a lot of ways. And so, you know, that's really
hard. I assume that you'd already rushed a frat and were dating a sorority girl.
Of course, yeah. And so that was, you know, that was a big, big event. And, you know, it was hard for me to make sense of, but you know, students were, you know, their opinions ran the gamut from, you know, oh, we have to invade Afghanistan and Iraq now, even though it wasn't clear who was behind things. Then, you know, there was actually a strong group of students, a fairly small group of students that, you know, wanted to kind of take a calmer approach to things, to think about things a little bit more. So I remember my first semester of undergrad, you know, becoming involved in some of, you know, not protests, but, you know, some sort of demonstrations or information campaigns to try to, like, nuance our understandings of what happened.
Yeah.
But at Duke, as far as, you know, political organizing goes, it's not, it's no Berkeley. So it's a very, very different scene. But, I mean, so the big issues, of course, the 4 years I was there, you know, the typical things of that were big at campuses in the early 2000s, you know, anti-sweatshops, trying to raise awareness of climate change, and of course, you know, when I was a sophomore in college, the Iraq War, when they invaded Iraq in 2003. So that was a big thing. But again, there weren't that many opportunities for mobilizing because it is North Carolina.
Yeah. And I think this is probably a good time to point out, this is this may be a sort of stating the obvious, but when we're talking about kind of the left or student activism here, we don't mean like the Democratic Party, or like this is not sort of young Democrats. And of course, with the Iraq War, so many Democratic senators and representatives voted for that.
Yeah.
Was there ever any tension, or did you ever have any interesting moments of solidarity with, say, like young Republicans at Duke, or were there any unexpected kind of ideological moments?
I mean, one thing that I got involved in my senior year, just because of the circle of friends that I was in, was a group, or, you know, some actions called Students Against Terror. So, and that was a really odd formation, because for the most part it was, you know, terror in terms of thinking that what's going on in Israel, Palestinian actions are terrorism.
Yeah.
Trying to think of the other way around. But, you know, there were some people involved in, you know, some of the events that were put on, I remember my senior year, that tried to think about things a little bit differently, to think about what actually terror was, and can, you know, a state actually, you know, commit acts of terror against
citizens.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of, you know, my friends who were, you know, involved in Students Against Terror, who, you know, very much on the side of Israel, weren't Republicans, you know, like Democrats as well, or identified as such. The group that I remember the most as an undergrad were the Objectivists. So the
AIMN
were very, very big as an undergrad, and I remember, you know,
these are people who love Ayn Rand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, I had some fun discussions, you know, as an undergrad with these students, but interesting discussions, and, you know, really, some really intelligent people, obviously with different ideological views and aims than I do. So.
And now you're back at Berkeley, back to California, but in a very different environment. What prompted the decision to do graduate study at all in the first place? And how is the ideological climate different from Orange County, Durham?
Yeah. I mean, so it's funny. Originally, when I was applying to graduate school, most of the programs I applied to were English programs to study Irish poetry, because that's what I had done my undergrad thesis on, and it's something that I was really interested in. But I, at the urging of one of a professor that I did an independent study with at Duke in the theater department, I applied to a couple of programs, you know, that were performance studies, that were, or American studies, so trying to nuance my, you know, what I could do as a graduate student.
Yep.
And so me deciding on Berkeley, you know, basically was prompted by a desire to be back in California where a lot of my friends were, my family obviously was.
Yeah.
It was, you know, the Bay Area is a place I always wanted to live, and also the department that I was going to, and just the humanities and social sciences in general at Berkeley. I thought, you know, some of the most exciting things going on in academia were going on at Berkeley.
Yeah.
And that I could, you know, and that was also a time in which I was starting to second guess or, you know, rethink my desire to spend my life studying Irish poetry, even though it's something that, you know, I find incredibly interesting, but it was also a time that, you know, politically I was starting to think differently about the relationship of, you know, academic work and social organizing or activism.
Sure.
And I thought that, you know, going into a performance studies program where I could perhaps, you know, study protest as, you know, a cultural practice as well as a political practice could be an interesting way that I could kind of put together my activist interests and my academic interests.
Yeah, I mean, the topic of kind of depoliticization in the academy is something that I think about a lot, and when I think about issues of, okay, would I like to be in the academy versus do something else, albeit with a scholarly training, that's definitely something that caused me to feel sort of negative, more negative about the academy at times. Is, you know, you compare, well, trying to think of this one guy. Who's the guy that wrote Amusing Earth? Neil Postman.
Okay.
You know, you compare figures like that to, I would say, at least in history, a lot of the American professor in that one discipline. And I don't think that the current situation compares super favorably to some figures from the previous generation.
Yeah.
But in any event, so with performance studies, what would be the sort of given the argument for what the kind of problem is with a literature department or with a history department? Like, what are these people missing or not emphasizing enough? Or who are the kind of people that they're not having conversations with enough to do really interesting projects that you think one does get within this different tradition of performance studies?
Yeah, I mean, well, performance studies, I mean, just to state something that's obvious for those of us who work in performance studies, it's very much a interdiscipline. So it's incredibly interdisciplinary. A lot of people in my department, you know, come to Berkeley with a theater background, but not all of them. I myself didn't have a very, very strong theater background, especially in theater practice. It's something that actually I've developed more as a grad student than before.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what performance can add to something like history, I think, is not so much a question of, like, what it can add as what exchanges can be had and what, you know, what performance studies can learn from history and vice versa. And so one thing that performance studies that I really appreciate about it is, you know, from in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was a real emphasis in different disciplines of, you know, reading culture as text.
Yes.
One thing that performance studies does is try to think about culture not just in terms of text, in terms of reading, in terms of discourse, but also in terms of performance.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of questions of embodiment, subjectivity, ritual action, symbolic action.
Yeah.
Obviously, the terms of, you know, reading culture, writing culture are still really important, really very much informs a lot of the methodologies and approaches to studying culture and politics that are popular within performance studies. But, you know, it takes things a slightly different way. Obviously, it's a lot harder. When I talk to historians, sometimes it's difficult to explain and to justify and to rationalize how we study human actions, you know, that don't necessarily have textual evidence that we can refer to.
Right.
But that's one of the rich things I think about.
Maybe just a simple example that I think may illustrate what we're talking about here. I would maybe think of presidential inaugurations. Right, where I would think a more traditional or textually different approach would be like, okay, well, I'm just going to look at the speech of Kennedy's inaugural or like Bush's second inaugural versus Obama's, and like this will tell us sort of what the deal is.
Yeah.
Where I would think one could productively not only compare the atmosphere or the staging or what have you of these different inaugurations. I mean, I don't even remember why they did this, but I think with Reagan's first or second inaugural, they did it on the back steps of the Capitol rather than the front steps.
Yeah.
I don't remember why. By looking at things like that.
Exactly. I mean, thinking of questions of, you know, this is more kind of the theater studies genealogy that goes into performance studies. Yeah, thinking in terms of dramaturgy, thinking in terms of, you know, just questions of, you know, what someone is actually wearing, the way in which they're carrying themselves. Again, you know, the backdrop that they're setting a speech against. You know, I mean, Obama is obviously has become a master of, you know, kind of performance in his presidency. But I mean, that also reflects also kind of the increasingly visual multimedia world that we're living in. And that, you know, you're not just reading a text of an Obama speech in the New York Times anymore. You're watching it on YouTube. And so, you know, as politics emphasize more and more kind of performative aspects, so scholars need to as well to address these aspects of things.
I feel sometimes like I've seen, not that it's necessarily a bad thing, but it's just it seems to repeat itself a lot. I feel like I've seen photographs of Obama in almost every like small industrial center in like Ohio or Indiana in the last 2 years, as opposed to just seeing these things.
Yeah. And this isn't to say that, you know, historians also aren't addressing these aspects, or historians or even, you know, political scientists, they are.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, to think more theoretically about some of the methods that perhaps historians, political scientists, other social scientists are using implicitly or, you know, unconsciously, I think would be a really, really interesting discussion to have. And these conversations are being had. So.
Yeah. So how do we get from entering Berkeley to... You're now on a Fulbright grant, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'm just finishing it.
Okay, yeah, like, I think literally a week.
And I also have, I'm here also with the Social Sciences Research Council. So again, this, you know, overlap to study Taft of Wissenschaft and be considered, I guess, you know, from a funding perspective as a social scientist.
Sure. So how do we get from entering Berkeley, moving from Irish poetry to... How do we chart the journey from Irish poetry to the German you left?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated journey. But, I mean, right after I finished undergrad, I knew that I didn't want to go straight into graduate school. I knew I wanted to take a year or two off. So, you know, why not move to Berlin? And so I moved to Berlin for, you know, personal reasons and also because it seemed like a very exciting thing to do. So that's when I started learning German and becoming really, really interested in the city of Berlin and more interested in German history,
sure.
And German culture, etc. So when I started my graduate studies at Berkeley, I still, you know, wasn't completely sure what my project was going to be, whether it was going to be in Ireland or in Germany. I was pretty certain that, you know, okay, I'm switching to Germany here.
Yeah.
As far as the period goes, I wasn't totally certain. The topic I was becoming increasingly... you know, certain that it's going to have something to do with protests mm-hmm. and activism and social organizing. And so really the decision to firmly focus on studying protests in Germany came right after my first year of graduate school. I came back to mm-hmm. Berlin to continue working on my German, and also I had, you know, vague ideas of doing some sort of project around the G8 Summit that was being held and having done
yes.
this year in 2007.
Yes. Which is on the Earth Sea and Mountain State.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So right by Rostock.
Yeah.
And, you know, the project that I thought of was, you know, I'd go there and do some, you know, kind of, you know, perhaps an ethnographic study of,
anti-globalization.
You know, exactly.
Yeah.
And just see where things were at this point, because 2007
yeah.
things were... You know, we're starting definitely to wane
yes.
With regards to the anti-globalization movement. And then right before the protest started, I got involved with a group called the Clandestine Insurgent Rebel Clown Army here in Berlin, which is, or it's still in existence, but it was really, really popular from 2003 to 2007.
Uh-huh.
And it was a group that was started by activists in London, in which basically people dress up like clowns that are also... police officers,
yep.
and they show up at these protests and, you know, add some color and some fun to things, but they also oftentimes help diffuse really, really militant or really potentially violent situations between activists
sure.
and
yep.
police. They're not necessarily policing demonstrations, but in a way to try to get people to reflect on kind of the actions that they're doing, but also in a way, you know, it's just fun. It adds color to some of these oftentimes really militant, very turbulent demonstrations.
Yep.
So I went to Heiligendamm with this group. I went through a Rebel Clown Army basic training, and I ended up doing a project with them that I then wrote up and published. And so I was like, okay, this is the project that I want to do. I want to study
yeah.
protest, performative forms of protest that aren't just, you know, sit-ins, demonstrations, marches, but, you know, try to use performance in a way that kind of changes the script that, you know, are normally associated with protests.
Yeah, in the sense of, okay, we're not just going through this thing again and again where we have people in beards on one side and police
yeah.
officers and they beat me up and, like, we sort of repeat this hundreds of
exactly,
times.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And then, you know, but then when I started kind of looking into the history of these forms, obviously I'd, you know, studied quite a bit about the Yippies and things that happened in the United States, I started to learn
yeah.
that there was actually really, really, really rich genealogy here in Germany that had been hardly studied at all, especially by American or British scholars.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that was shocking to me, just as I was doing some research for this, we can get to sort of this is a very complicated history, but at one point there were very significant protests in Bonn, which was the capital of West Germany then.
Mm.
And there were 80,000 students there, which might not sound like the world's largest number, but if you, I was just kind of doing the math on this, if you scale this in proportion to what a similar protest would be like in the United States, mm-hmm. it would be the equivalent of about 400,000 students showing up in Washington and basically demanding change to almost the equivalent of the Patriot Act, arguably, although it's hard to make total analogies between the two situations. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what this genealogy was? And here we're talking mostly about German students. I mean, I'm sure we can trace this back quite far, but let's maybe start with the mid to late 60s. So why was there a student movement in the late 60s as opposed to, like, in the 50s? Like, why this time in particular?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, obviously, when scholars talk about, you know, 1960 and student movements, you know, oftentimes there's a trend to thinking of things in terms of transnationalism. It's really, really popular within history right now. And other disciplines that think of the period around 1968 in terms of transnationalism, which I really support, and I think there's great things being done, and that's really influenced my own scholarship. But oftentimes in doing that, there's a tendency to lose sight of some of the particularities about things that were happening in particular countries, particular areas of the world, even in particular cities. So in Germany, for example, the 1960s, a whole number of factors came together, probably the most important of which was it was a time in which, you know, there was a coming of age of really the first generation to be born either during World War II or right after or right before. And so in the 1950s, a lot of, you know, there were quite a few demonstrations in the 1950s, just to be clear, in Germany. A lot that actually are oftentimes overlooked in historiography about the 1960s in Germany. So, you know, protests against rearmament, protests against the banning of the Communist Party. So there was, it was a pretty, you know, there were demonstrations, but obviously not on the same scale as in the 1960s. One of the most interesting things about, you know, when we're thinking about the question of why the 1960s, again, I think it has something to do with the fact that, you know, this is the first generation after World War II. And for a lot of students that were coming of age at this time, it wasn't until the early 1960s, the late 1950s, that they really started to learn what happened in Germany in the 1940s, to learn, you know, what perhaps their parents had had a hand in, what their teachers, what, you know, their president, their, a lot of the politicians, judges. And so, it was a, you know, there was a huge, you know, feeling of betrayal among a number of students in the 1960s that, you know, A, they hadn't been educated to know this stuff, that a lot of the structures that, you know, either allowed for fascism to, you know, take hold in Germany or that actually, you know, were leftovers from the fascist period were still in place in Germany. So there was, you know, kind of, I would say, you know, the 1960s, in answering this question, it really has to do very much so with, you know, students starting to realize like that, you know, there are things still in our society that haven't been taken care of. Fascism could, you know, perhaps still be here. A lot of authoritarian structures are still here. At least that was how they perceived things. And of course, when you take this, you know, when you take this together with things that were happening elsewhere in the world, particularly, you know, things that were developing in Berkeley in the early 1960s were really, really influential on a number of student groups. The writings of the Frankfurt School were becoming very popular in the very late 50s and early 60s and had a huge influence on a core group of students that then would, you know, in some way pave the way for the Germany left, which came about, you know, starting probably in 1965 or so.
And I think with the Frankfurt School connection, I think that you said you're going to Frankfurt, I think, this weekend, quite soon, to look at the archives of Theodor Adorno, the prominent philosopher and writer. This is a point where, oftentimes when I discuss Frankfurt School with friends or even other people who are doing history, I think it seems sometimes as like obscurantist or like hard to see what the link is. Maybe a good way to talk about the influence that these thinkers would have on the student movement, I would maybe ask the following question, which is like, you have a growing economy in West Germany, at least up until the mid-60s. So, you know, a question that you might ask one of these radicalized students is, look, what's the big deal? Why don't you just go get a job in a firm, sure, maybe your boss was like a former Nazi, but look, here's this money, you have a nice house, raise a family, mm-hmm. you know, what's the big deal? Mm-hmm. Why is that not a kind of compelling alternative for a lot of these young people?
I mean, it was a compelling alternative for most people. I mean, you know, most of the students that were really involved in the German New Left, you know, came from, you know, and they would admit this, bourgeois households.
Yeah.
And, you know, the political economic aspects of particularly the German New Left have been studied, but, you know, I would argue they haven't been studied enough. And I think that mm-hmm. there are a number of factors that coalesce around, you know, the end of the economic miracle in the late 1960s that likely had a huge effect on the students. That's not something that, unfortunately, that I'm able to get into too much in my project. But for me, the influence of the Frankfurt School on the students was, you know, you have, you know, thinking in particular about Adorno and Max Horkheimer, you know, you have these very, very prominent Jewish intellectuals who have to go into exile once Hitler comes to power. And then while they're in the United States, they're, for the most part, some of their major studies during their time of exile is thinking about what actually the authoritarian personality is. And, you know, coming up with some striking results and thinking that actually it's not something that is particular to Germany. It's not part of the Sonderweg. It's not like, you know, actually it's present in the U.S. It's present all over the place. And, you know, in the 1950s, Adorno especially was, and a lot of people forget this when they talk about his resignation in the late 1960s, he was an outspoken critic of German society, and especially the way in which West Germany was trying to grapple or dealing with its past. And so, you know, not only would he talk about how a number of the structures, legal structures, economic structures, even political structures, are still present, that were present under Hitler, but also this very important form is the notion of Erziehung. So, you know,
not just purely education, but a sort of moral upbringing.
Exactly, the way in which people are raising their children is perhaps, you know, laying the foundations again for maybe not a new Nazi party, but similarly destructive authoritarian tendencies in society. And so, you know, this work by Adorno and some of the earlier work from Horkheimer in the 30s and 40s, as well as Marcuse, began being published either in pirated editions or, you know, new work, especially by Marcuse, was being published in the 1960s. And students started reading this work and started saying, oh, these guys, they were, you know, they went through all of this in the late 1920s and 1930s, and now they're kind of saying the same thing again. Now, we should probably start paying attention to this. These are people that we really respect. These are public intellectuals. Really important is to remember that Marcuse, especially, and Adorno were public intellectuals, and Horkheimer as well. So, I mean, their influence is not just on students, but, you know, on a broad section of the left.
And I think maybe the last thing we just have to add very briefly before kind of delving into a more performance-centric discussion of 1968 and student movements is even though many of these students were political, I mean, there's the shift in German politics that would very roughly be equivalent to sort of Democrats and Republicans announcing they were just going to form one big party. And like Bernie Sanders is now the only opposition senator or something like that. Talk a little bit about that and why that was important, and then I guess maybe we can begin to start perhaps with the Shah's visit and go into a kind of discussion of the performance aspect or the protests themselves from there.
Well, I mean, from the founding of the Federal Republic of Germany, basically the State Ewe, the conservative right in Germany, had held power up until 1966. And Konrad Adenauer, in particular, had held power for most of that time.
Yes.
And then in 1966, due to, you know, a number of factors, not the least being, you know, the end of the economic miracle, but, you know, a lot of efforts by students, by artists, by politicians as well, there was kind of a shift in which the SPD, the Social Democrats, were able to make enough electoral gains that the CDU was forced to make a coalition government with them. For a number of people, you know, who are very big fans of the SPD, like Gunter Grass, for example, you know, this was a great thing. It didn't matter that they were in a coalition with the CDU, but that the SPD was, you know, finally had some say that there was more of a liberal voice, more of a leftist voice in running the country. That was big. For a lot of people, though, they felt it was not only betrayal of the SPD betrayed them, because a lot of students in the early 1960s and mid-1960s were working on the election campaigns for the SPD.
Right.
Now, so a lot of people felt this was, you know, either a betrayal or kind of this view that, oh, now 95% of the Bundestag, 95% of the parliament is controlled by the same coalition. There's not a whole lot of room for opposition there.
Right.
So a lot of people date the founding of the German New Left, the birth of the German New Left, to kind of the birth of this grand coalition government in late 1966. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes when people talk about the German New Left, they talk about it using also the name of the extra-parliamentary opposition.
Right.
So trying to think of politics that did not, forms of politics, modes of political engagement, mm-hmm. That did not just take place
Formal institutions.
Exactly, informal institutions, but on the streets, in, you know, theaters, in universities, mm-hmm. all over the place.
So let's shift a little bit from talking about kind of more structural economic or political changes to almost the performance aspect of this, or the protests or sit-ins and teach-ins and so on. It strikes me that maybe the most congenial place to start with this is when Mr. Pakhlavi, the Shah of Iran, visits Berlin in, I think, fall of 67?
It was June 2nd, 1967. Yeah.
Okay. What happens, and how is that related to other tactics or forms of extra-parliamentary protest or political engagement that the students are engaged in at this time?
Yeah, so, I mean, June 2nd, 1967, most historians, most people that are familiar with the German New Left agree that this is kind of the decisive moment in the emergence of the New Left in Germany. You know, there had been demonstrations and organizing, you know, for years before. I claim that, you know, you can really kind of study the emergence of the German New Left back to, like, 1958, 1959.
Yeah.
But, you know, June 2nd is oftentimes taken as, like, the watershed moment. Mm-hmm. So the Shah of Persia was coming, as they call him, the Shah of Persia was coming.
Most, like, arrogant, like, comments.
Yeah, exactly. Was invited by the West German government to have a state visit in Munich, Berlin, Hamburg, in early June 1967.
Right.
At that time, especially in West Berlin, a number of students had already been organizing demonstrations that were in solidarity with third world liberation movements and mm-hmm. movements in other countries. So there was a big, you know, there were, again, a number of, like, the students who were part of this group called the SDS, so kind of the German Socialist Students League. They had been organizing protests against the visits of other third world leaders to Germany and about other third world issues for some time. Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, June 2nd was, you know, perfect, was another opportunity to protest, you know, West Germany's tacit or in some cases explicit financial and ideological support for, you know, what the students thought were tyrants and dictators. And so June 2nd came around and there was a massive, massive mobilization that was caused by a number of events that had happened in the months leading up, but when the Shah of Persia came on June 2nd, mm-hmm. Protests erupted like there had not been, you know, since probably Weimar, especially from the left.
And I mean, I imagine these would be recognizable, certainly, but what, if I'm like a protest organizer mm-hmm. in Berkeley or Orange County today, you know, assuming that they exist in Orange County, what would look different then as opposed to now in terms of how these things are organized or how they staged the event?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, this protest in itself, it actually was a fairly, there were organized calls for people to come out to the city hall and to come out to protest kind of this performance of Mozart at the German Opera House,
right,
that the Shah and his wife were invited to. So there were two demonstrations that were planned. What's interesting is at the first demonstration, early in the afternoon outside of the city hall, about 2,000 or 3,000 protesters showed up. There were a ton. There was a huge, huge police deployment, but there was also about 100 members of Iran's secret service who were there, who were, you know, supposedly supporters and fans of the Shah, but who had 4 to 6 foot long sticks, and they were allowed by the police to go and, you know, basically start beating students, and so that, you know, laid a foundation for a very, very, very violent and militant encounter later that night in front of the German Opera House, and at which point, you know, things turned very, very very, very violent, and it resulted in numerous injuries, numerous arrests, and the death of one 26-year-old student, Benoît Mazur, who was shot in the back by a police officer, a plainclothes police officer, who recently was revealed as being a Stasi agent. But in some regards, you know, the protest, the way it was organized, is very similar to, you know, protests today. There were, you know, really great signs, really clever signs. There was this one group, Kommune Eins, which figures very, very prominently in my dissertation. They were like a radical activist commune in West Berlin, who had a huge, huge influence on the German New Left, but who also really emphasized on trying to think of political engagement in terms that were different than, you know, just holding a demonstration or rally, but, you know, thought of, you know, like, you know, wouldn't it be funny if we, you know, assassinated Hubert Humphrey with a bunch of water balloons filled with pie and cake mix and everything else. They had tried to do this a couple months before.
This almost makes me wonder, somewhat facetiously, but also somewhat seriously, when the tradition of, you know, people running on stage and throwing a pie, or like a green pie, in the face of a politician became...
Exactly. I mean, so Kommune Eins at this demonstration, one of the big things that they did is they, along with students of the SDS and other students, made hundreds and hundreds of... They took hundreds and hundreds of brown shopping bags and put the face of the Shah and his wife on these shopping bags. So you have these amazing, amazing photos of students, you know, lined up in front of lines of police with these basically grocery bags on their head, with the photos of the Shah and his wife on them. Basically, you know, to show that, you know, it not only created a very, very amazing image that, you know, was circulated around the world in various newspapers, but, you know, at least for, you know, the police there, it was kind of a reminder of this, you're protecting these people and their interests, and you're not really protecting our interests as well. And, you know, we're trying to protest, we think that, you know, it's absolutely, absolutely horrific that the West German government is, you know, actually
let this oppressive leader,
exactly, you know, is receiving him, you know, as a state visitor. You know, so I would say, you know, if you want to compare today and then, at least in this protest, you know, what organizers did was, you know, fairly similar.
I get, you know, talking about in the left or the student movement during this period, two countries which we have not really talked about yet, and this was a very complicated moment, and student movement is very complicated, but we haven't talked, I don't think we've mentioned the Soviet Union yet, and we haven't really talked about China, which of course was ruled by Mao. Then, when these people consider themselves, when they talk about being socialists or leftists, particularly in this West German context, many of them in Berlin City, obviously surrounded by communist East Germany, what was the relationship like with Soviet Union, especially after the Prague Spring, or with China?
I mean, very, very differently. You know, the way in which students thought about the Soviet Union was incredibly different than the way in which they thought about China, especially in the late 1960s. So, I mean, not just because it was West Berlin or West Germany where students, you know, very suspicious of the Soviet project at this time. But, you know, it was a concern shared by a number of, you know, I think one of the characteristics shared by the New Left internationally was trying to think of, you know, what project the left could undertake that wasn't necessarily associated with, you know, the Soviet project. And, you know, especially in West Germany, obviously also in France, Maoism was a big, big deal.
Yeah.
But especially after, you know, June 2nd, people started reading Mao's Little Red Book, and mm-hmm. Maoism became very, very popular, especially the notion of the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah.
So to think in terms that, you know, the revolution that we're going to accomplish, or, you know, the project that we're going to try to accomplish, won't just be about, you know, taking state power, making new laws, but it's going to be kind of a revolution of everyday life. You know, that's a very common phrase that's associated with 1968.
Right, and what's the phrase of Kommune Eins? Everything personal is political, or the other way around?
I mean, that necessarily wasn't, you know, Kommune Eins's motto, but that was, you know, part of the spirit that, you know, the personal is political, which nowadays, you know, that's a very common and perhaps in some regard trite phrase to use. But, you know, that was a pretty revolutionary statement at the time, to think that, you know, especially with what they call the New Women's Movement mm-hmm. in Germany, that really came about in kind of late 1968, this idea that that politics, especially radical politics, isn't just, you know, us versus the state, but it's, you know, the actual relations that we have towards one another within even radical groups.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that was really, really important for groups like Kommune Eins, and especially the various groups that would come about with regards to the New Women's Movement.
And maybe, I mean, just since you've been working on it more closely recently, and so we have some idea, how were decisions made within something like Kommune Eins? If I'm living at one of these apartments, like, what is like my life like on a day-to-day basis, or if I want to... I'm like, you know, shame and tired of, you know, you smell or something, or I want you to make me dinner. How does that work?
I mean, Kommune Eins is really, really complicated and difficult to talk about, like, especially when you want to talk about decision-making and organization. I mean, it wasn't necessarily rational decisions a lot of the time. But Kommune Eins emerged out of, again, a desire to rethink not only activist relationships with the state, but to think of, you know, everyday relations, to rethink them fundamentally. So decisions, you know, when you have six or seven people living together, which was, you know, for six or seven young people to live together in one place was a radical thing in West Germany. The whole idea of the WG, the Wohngemeinschaft, which, you know, everyone under the age of 35 now, you know, lives in, you know, that was created by Kommune Eins. So, I mean, for them, decisions, you know, about what... events to take part in, how to do things, where, you know, we're supposedly communal, but there are, you know, a lot of memoirs and, you know, people that have looked back on the time talk about, you know, there, you know, also was a hierarchy. It was, you know, fairly, like, chauvinistic, like, you know, men definitely dominated the women in sort of decision-making, etc.
Yep.
I mean, and in the SDS as well, the German Social Students League, which was kind of the main body of the German New Left, main organizational body of the German New Left. You know, it was also, you know, despite this claim or aspiration to be, you know, fundamentally and radically democratic, you know, it was still fairly hierarchical. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, still elected leaders. There, you know, a lot of the critiques that came from, again, this New Women's Movement was that it was also very, very masculinist.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a whole lot of room for women, especially women who had children, who couldn't make all the meetings, who couldn't, you know, do the same thing. So, I mean, it was much more democratic than what was going on in the Grand Coalition, but it was still highly problematic in some regards. But, you know, there were these utopian aspirations, which I think are important to think about and to consider when evaluating.
It's probably a little bit trite. I think some of this reminds me of, I think the saying is something like, socialism is a great idea, like, only, like, nobody has enough time for it, or like, it would take too much time.
Yeah, yeah. There's also a great quote from Ulrike Meinhof's ex-husband, who was founder of Konkret, who said, you know, enjoy capitalism because socialism will be tough. So this idea that, you know, it's going to be a lot of work, and to, you know, actually, you know, build a society or even, like, you know, country... around, you know, the ideal of socialism, it's not going to be easy. And obviously, you know, the limitations of the SDS of Kommune Eins reveal how difficult that actually is.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about what sort of happens to these people, or the legacy of it. They, if I remember correctly, go to Bonn in, I think, the spring or summer of 68 or 69, I forget which, and they are staging a protest against these emergency laws that the Grand Coalition had been making part of its political program for a while. There's a big protest in Bonn, but they did not succeed in halting the legislation. Do we consider this is that moment a failure, or why did that not work for them?
Yeah, I mean, so again, if you're thinking of, you know, kind of the timeline of the Germany left, June 2nd, 1967 was a big event, and that had to do with, you know, not just Iran, but also it was, you know, somewhat associated with protests against the war in Vietnam.
Yeah,
so all of these protests against, you know, American imperialism and West Germany support of it. What happens in 1968, in April and May of 1968, you know, right as things are starting to happen, you know, in Prague, in France, was for a long, long time, the State EU had been trying to pass the set of emergency laws that would give, you know, the government, you know, sovereign power in times of declared emergency, but it was also kind of the last condition for having total independence from the Allied forces. So they had to pass these emergency laws in order, you know, for the Americans, the French, the British, to, you know, kind of like give them almost complete sovereignty.
Yeah, and not to get into too much technical detail here, but if I'm not mistaken, part of the, I mean, one argument you can marshal in favor of these things, in addition to the procedural stuff with American or French support, was, I think, without these laws in place, if there was like a forest fire, like a big accident, I think it was very difficult to send the like German army or a national German force to like a specific province. A lot of the stuff had to be handled on a, this would be the equivalent almost of like the National Guard not being allowed to, FEMA not being allowed to deploy.
And that was the rhetoric by the CDU and increasingly by the SPD. But, you know, the opposition said, hey, do you remember how Hitler came to power? Through a similar set of emergency laws.
Yes.
Or emergency decrees. So let's prevent that. And also, a lot of students, a lot of workers, you know, in reading through the legislation, the proposed legislation, you know, realized that, you know, it would be much harder to strike.
Yep.
It would be, the criminalization of dissent would be much easier and perhaps, you know, much more extreme, which in the 1970s, that proved true. Granted, there was the Red Army faction that was planting a lot of it. but still, so, you know, throughout the, you know, late 1950s and the 1960s, the CDU had been lobbying to try to pass this legislation, but they never had, you know, a grand coalition that would actually allow them to do this. And then in 1968, it became clear that, you know, with SPD, you know, allied with SPD, they could pass these laws. And students, obviously, had for a long time been against these laws, and they, along with another big campaign against rearmament that had started in the 1950s, mobilized to get workers, to get, you know, pretty much everyone they could to protest against these laws. And it was a huge, huge, huge campaign. And in April and May of 1968, there were huge demonstrations like in Bonn. One thing that I'm really interested in is, you know, one of the main sites of protest and demonstration were in the theaters. So a number of theater groups and theater ensembles, you know, would cancel performances or interrupt performances to try to engage in discussions with the audiences. So that's, for me, that's a fascinating moment. but yeah, and then, you know, the laws were passed in late May, or I believe it was early June. And, you know, that was demoralizing for a number of students, but also proved, you know, kind of a point in which it was clear that the workers and the students, you know, that was really the only shared political project that they had. And so there was, again, the split, and again, the students, like they had been a year before, and, you know, years before in the protests against Vietnam, you know, again, we're alone. And then what you have happen is, you know, an escalation in violence and an increasing turn to militancy, which had been present, which weren't just prompted by the passage of the emergency laws, but, you know, were also prompted by the attempted assassination of Rudi Dutschke in April of 1968, and a number of other factors.
And So as we head into the 70s, it's interesting because it seems like on a concrete level, at least with this specific legislation, that seems like we have to say it's a failure. But like we're talking about with the vague A's, the phone combined shaft and shared apartments, it seems like as a cultural project, it was maybe successful is not the right word, but had an undeniable influence, even though the immediate political gains were not so impressive.
Again, I mean, that's incredibly important, because when you're thinking of an extra-parliamentary opposition, they're not necessarily going to be anticipating making parliamentary gains.
Yeah.
So it was a very, very, it was a radicalizing moment for a number of students. It was demoralizing. When I say demoralizing, I mean, it was demoralizing in the sense that they're realizing kind of actually there are limits to what we can do with this parliamentary system. And so for a number of people, that just kind of increases conviction that what was going on in Bonn with the federal government, with, you know, the local and state government, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of hope in trying to pursue things on that route,
sure,
at least with the given parties. Now, you do have, you know, in the 1970s, a member of 68ers went and founded the Green Party.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was this long march through the institutions, a famous phrase from Duschke. But for a number of people, it was a really, really radicalizing moment in terms of, like, becoming even more of an extra-parliamentary opposition,
right.
Being more opposed to the parliamentary politics than before.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I think what you're saying about sort of the true meaning of an extra-parliamentary opposition is really important. I mean, when occasionally I read authors or people coming from kind of like the left, we could say, in America today, you know, a common criticism obviously is saying, oh, look, you know, you weren't able to stop the war in Iraq, or, oh, look, you weren't able to stop the Patriot Act. But it seems like realizing that, at least in this German case, the APO, it's like it was extra parliamentary, and like that didn't just mean it was like literally not in parliament, but it was trying to have institutional gains.
Yeah.
Although it's more complicated, like what Duschke was saying.
Exactly. I mean, and you know, even though the campaign against the emergency laws failed on a parliamentary level or legislative level, it was a moment in which the extra-parliamentary opposition became a national movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that they were able to mobilize so many people, not just in West Berlin, not just in Frankfurt, not just in Hamburg, not just in parts of Munich, which had, you know, formerly been kind of the hotbeds of the Oppo, but, you know, from an organizing and mobilizing standpoint, that was a huge, huge victory.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I can't emphasize enough that this moment was a big, big radicalizing moment. If you compare flyers, you know, for example, from, you know, around June 2nd, 1967, to the flyers that then were starting to be produced in the fall of 1968,
sure,
they were much more radical. Violence was much more accepted, much more discussed.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, just kind of the terms that they're using, it was much more kind of, you know, Marxist and radical liberatory rhetoric than before.
Right, and yeah, I mean, we don't have to go into the Red Army faction for this interview, but if you take the ideology or the concept of an extra-parliamentary opposition too far, you can, I think, come to this point where all institutional politics is illegitimate and fascist, and maybe even these people have to be, you know, you say, oh, these people are evil, they have to be eliminated or something like that, which is, I don't think, very productive in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I mean, the Red Army faction is a whole other can
sure.
of worms, which,
yeah.
you know, in starting my project, I thought that I would be able to make it into the 1970s with the Red Army faction, the Zweite Juni Bewegung, but, you know, there are links, but there are other things that happen to, you know, change kind of the, you know, to make the Red Army faction possible. So,
right,
yeah.
Right. And so, kind of a big question that we, you know, we're now living in a Berlin where, as we've said, people, you know, young people, you know, live in these apartment complexes together, has a fairly open, I would say, or at least it seems to me, kind of theater community, and seems, at least compared to London or New York, from what I've seen, a relatively easy mixing of experimental or socialist or left-wing politics with the arts world. What were some of the long-term gains, do you think, or the long-term effects that this moment had on sort of everyday German culture?
I mean, you know, Jürgen Habermas is probably like made the most famous pronouncement of like the legacy of the late 60s, and that it, you know, affected a like fundamental liberalization of German culture, German politics, structures, etc. Which, you know, I'm sympathetic with, definitely, and I agree. But, you know, it also, you know, in the 1950s and early 1960s, although there had been these mobilizations against, you know, rearmament and nuclear weapons in Germany, politics was basically thought to take place, you know, on election day and to take place in
ballot box.
Exactly. Or exactly, like in, you know, the parliament.
Sure.
And, you know, one thing I would argue, and which I do argue, is that, you know, and a lot, and this isn't an original argument, is that, you know, the German New Left really introduced, or not introduced, reintroduced a mode of political engagement that, you know, wasn't strictly, you know, confined to parliamentarism. Which is hugely, hugely important, especially in the 1970s when there were increasing protests against nuclear weapons. I mean nuclear power, and then the 1980s in Berlin with all the, you know, the squatter scene. I would say, you know, the very condition of possibility for that, in addition to kind of political and economic and other objective conditions, was kind of the legacy and the tactics that were learned and experimented with in the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you see that continuing today, and that's not just something that's West German or German-specific, but, you know, France, the U.S., et cetera. I mean, so that's, for me, that's probably one of the most important and most interesting legacies. But, you know, obviously there are all the developments in culture and, you know, the whole the whole basically cultural industry around of nostalgia around the 1960s. That is so that's one that I'm not too fond of.
Yeah.
That is also, that needs to be grappled with and addressed, obviously.
So I think you're, if I'm not mistaken, you're going back to the States in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You'll presumably be in Berkeley for some time, and, you know, who knows, but probably in the United States. You know, hopefully in academia, like, we'll see in the long run. When you look at these this historical moment, you know, not just as a scholar, but somebody interested in social organizing, or like what like the left could be in 21st century America, and so on. What concrete lessons, if any, do you think somebody interested in organizing or social justice or anti-globalization or I mean, these causes that are associated with kind of American leftism today? What lessons can you take from this moment?
I mean, one thing that I'm countless. I mean, but
out of millions,
I mean, one thing that I'm particularly interested in as an activist today, and that in my dissertation as well, that I'm really interested in, is this question of the criminalization of dissent,
mm-hmm.
and how that functions, how dissent becomes, you know, an object of criminalization, or, you know, when the media or politicians or, you know, just the public at large starts to think of certain political projects as not legitimate but instead criminal. And I think organizing against such things, you know, is really, really, really important. And, you know, is, in one regard, is a really good way to mobilize and organize, you know, to say, you know, this person being arrested and charged with, you know, a felony for being at a demonstration is completely unjust and terrible.
Right.
And, you know, I think, you know, that's really important and very, very productive. But, you know, there's a tendency, and this is probably, you know, this was something that happened with the German left, and especially with the Red Army faction,
mm-hmm.
Is that there became a tendency for political projects to become self-referential. So to become, you know, just about protesting the criminalization of dissent and losing sight of other aims and other potential projects that could be undertaken.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at least as an activist, I think that's one of the most important things to be taken away, is that, you know, to really not become self-referential in a way. And for me, at least, as an activist today, you know, of course I hated if friends get arrested or when, you know, disciplinary hearings at Berkeley are being brought up against people. But, you know, to make that's a very, very important and valuable way to organize people and to make solidarity, but it also can't take the place of organizing for other projects or other aims and goals.
Yeah. No, it's interesting thinking about a thing. I mean, when I think back to this moment in Germany, if I'm not mistaken, many of these people, I guess college was free, or I think they may have gotten a stipend along with it even. And I think at some point, I think until the late 60s in West Germany, you could essentially be a student for a very long time.
There was a lot of contention around that.
But then it seems, I mean, from the perspective of activism, organizing, it seems like you compare that moment, whatever its like benefits and minuses may have been for the taxpayer and so on, to now where we've shifted in the United States, at least to a very private, debt-driven financing of higher education, which seems like, well, it's one thing to sort of squat in a Berlin apartment in 1968. It's another thing to be an activist and based out of downtown San Francisco.
I mean, if anything, to think of, what is positive about the conditions for activism today, especially in universities among the student movement.
Yeah.
In the late 1960s, especially in West Germany, there was a big, big topic of conversation and among activists was, an attempt to justify that students being some sort of revolutionary subject.
Yeah.
Or why, trying to explain to the media why are us middle-class kids or upper-middle-class kids protesting against the war in Vietnam. So this continual attempt to justify what they're doing, which, I think the justifications they came up with were correct and sincere for the most part.
Yeah.
But today, it seems, they're even more positive and hopefully favorable conditions for organizing students because, like you mentioned, there's, an increasing amount of debt that students have to take on in order to receive an education.
Yeah.
Hopefully that, will yield. I mean, it is yielding positive and productive conditions for organizing today, but, hopefully that will become more and more true. Because, for students in the late 1960s, the big critique that was leveled against them, not only by, the conservative media, but also by their mentors in the Frankfurt School and others, were saying that, what you're doing is all voluntaristic. It's all about, the subjective will, the objective conditions are not right for revolution in West Germany. I'm not saying the objective conditions are right for revolution in the U.S. It's up in the air. I don't think that, I think it's, there are objective things that we can organize around and that we should be getting out there and protesting and demonstrating and figuring out other tactics and other ways to get our messages across and,
Well, I think we'll leave it at that. So, thanks so much for joining us on this our first ever Berlin episode. Hopefully, the first of many. This sounds like a wonderful project, and we wish you the best of luck with it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Thanks for tuning in to the Historical Gadfly. Again, I'm your host, Timothy Noonan, of the University of Oxford. If you have any questions, suggestions, or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch with us at historicalgadfly@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.